Good afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon, taking your calls, as always. If you have questions you'd like to call in and discuss on the air about the Bible, about Christianity, anything like that, you don't have to be favorable toward Christianity to call in. You don't have to be agreeable with the host, though you do need to be polite and, you know, obviously use language suitable for radio. Anyway, that being said, we have one of our lines open at this point. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That number is 844-484-5737. Tomorrow morning in Temecula, we have our monthly men's Bible study. Many of you have been to that and just need to be reminded once a month that that's when we're doing it. If you've never been to the study and you don't know where it is, you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, and look under the tab that says Announcements, and you'll find all the information you need about any of my speaking engagements anywhere. And remember, those of you in the Midwest or who may be in the Wisconsin, somewhere in Wisconsin next month, on March 6th, I will be in Onalaska, Wisconsin, and at a large church that has asked me to come, and we're going to have a debate between myself and Joel Richardson, which will have to do with the fulfillment of the promises that God made to David. Have they been fulfilled now, or will that happen when he comes back, when Jesus comes back? So that's the debate. It's March 6th. That will be listed also at our website, thenarrowpath.com, under Announcements. And now we'll go to the phones and talk to Ryan in Linfield, Washington. Ryan, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. It's Linwood.
Oh, what'd I say?
Linfield.
Oh, did I say Linfield? I'm sorry. I'm looking at Linwood.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
So when it comes to the evidence for the resurrection, I feel like I have that down really well. But for some reason, I've just never been able to present, at least for myself, a really convincing argument for the empty tomb. I was just wondering if you could present a really good argument for that, and I'll take it off the air.
Well, don't go away yet.
When
you say an argument for the empty tomb, you mean an argument to prove the point that the tomb was empty?
An apologetics. Just because I try and think about it from, of somebody who doubts their perspective.
Sure.
And I would raise the same questions that I've heard, which is, well, that somebody just took the body or stuff like that. So if you could please give me the argument.
Okay. Well, thanks for your call. Well, the tomb is clearly empty 3 days after Jesus was buried. There's no reputable historian who doubts that Jesus lived, okay? That Jesus was a historical character is established by historical documents, secular and religious, and from several different sources. Real historians really never doubted that Jesus lived. There are atheists who are not historians, and some of them have felt that Jesus never lived. Others believe he lived, as virtually everyone knowledgeable knows. Now, if he lived, he also died, unless he's, 2,000 years old right now. So that Jesus lived and died is not really a controversial position. The question is, did he rise again? Now, there's two lines of argument for the resurrection. One is that the tomb was empty, which has to be explained 3 days after he was buried there. And the other is that people say they saw him. After he rose from the dead, they encountered him, touched him, talked with him, ate with him. After he'd risen from the dead. So those are two lines of evidence that are quite important. And obviously, unbelievers have tried to come up with explanations for both those things. Now, first of all, how do we know? How do we know the tomb is empty? Well, all the historical records on the subject tell us so. And there are no historical records that's given alternative views. So we've got multiple accounts, and they're certainly not guilty of copying each other, since the accounts of the resurrection appearances and so forth are so different from one gospel to the next, that it's very obvious that these authors were not colluding together. But one thing they all agree about is the tomb was empty. And there's not really any reason for any skeptic to doubt that the tomb was empty, because if it was not, it would have soon been discovered not to be empty, because the disciples who claimed that the tomb was empty and who claimed that Jesus rose from the dead were publicly declaring this in Jerusalem, the very town where Jesus was crucified and buried, within a few weeks after his death. They were saying he's alive. Now, if he was still in the tomb, that would have been so easy to disprove. That is, that it could be proven that he hadn't risen from the dead, because his dead body could be found in the tomb. And, by the way, many people were highly motivated to shut the apostles up. They were arrested more than once. They were threatened. Their lives were threatened if they don't stop preaching that Jesus rose from the dead. I mean, obviously, some people really were upset at this preaching. And it would have been the easiest thing in the world for any skeptic or enemy of the Christian message to simply go to the tomb and say, look, here's his body, so let's have no more of this nonsense about him rising from the dead. The fact that no one ever did that is only because they couldn't. And the reason they couldn't is because if they did go to the tomb, the body wasn't there to present it. I mean, there's just no common sense that would tell us that the tomb was not empty and the dead body was there. And yet all the people who wanted to silence the apostles and disprove the gospel, they just never thought to look, really. Or they did look and the body was there and said, okay, well, we're just not going to tell anyone about it. We now know the body's there, but we're just not going to mention it. No, I mean, this is the thing that would be most publicized by the enemies of Christianity, who were numerous. So the fact that the tomb was empty is a given. I don't think there's anyone on the planet who has ever looked into the information, Christian or non-Christian, who would doubt that the tomb was empty. It had to be, or else Christianity would not exist today. It would have been so easy to disprove it. Now, of course, the question is, how did the tomb get empty? Enemies of the gospel have come up with theories, but none of them make any sense. Some say that the disciples went to the wrong tomb. Well, I don't think so, because the women, several women, watched Jesus being buried. And the man who owned the tomb he was buried in was a secret believer. And he certainly knew where the tomb was because he owned it. And, as a Christian, if someone had initially mistaken the right tomb for a different one, he certainly wouldn't make that mistake. The idea that the tomb that was empty wasn't the same one Jesus was buried in, simply, it just requires us to be stupid to believe that. It's just desperate. So, I mean, the fact that the tomb was empty after Jesus buried in it means that somehow the body it ceased to be there. Now, the Christian message is that Jesus rose from the dead just like he predicted he would. He, on three occasions before he was even arrested, he told his disciples, I'm going to be killed, and I'm going to be buried, and I'm going to rise on the third day. And lo and behold, on the third day, his body's gone. And people claim to have met him and seen him, numerous people in different places. So, I mean, that's the simple answer, is he rose from the dead. But let's just say someone doesn't want to believe that answer. What other answers are there? Well, the only other answer would be some other human agents removed his body. If he didn't get up and walk out of the tomb, someone else carried his dead body out. Who did that? And who would have a motive? And if they even did have a motive, why would they keep it a secret? Now, obviously, the main parties that had any interest in or even awareness of Jesus were the Jews, who condemned him, the Romans who crucified him, and the believers who still believed in him. Now, the Romans and the Jews were among those that were the enemies of Christianity. As soon as, Jesus was buried, and then, the disciples started saying he's alive again, the Romans were not pleased with that, and the Sanhedrin, the Jews, were not pleased with that. So it's obvious that they didn't remove the body, because even if they did, and by the way, they could have. The Romans in particular would have been in the position to move the body if they wanted to, but they'd have no motivation to move it. And if they did have a motivation to move it, they would have no motivation to keep it a secret. As I said earlier, if the enemies of Christianity could have produced the body for public display, they certainly would have done it. And that would have been the end of Christianity before Christianity escaped the boundaries of Jerusalem. And so, I mean, the fact that the Romans and the Jews maybe could have moved the body, but would have no reason to. And if they did do it, they would have no reason to keep it a secret. Makes those theories nonsense. That leaves only one possibility, other than that Jesus, you know, left the tomb himself under his own power. And that is that his followers removed it and then decided to perpetrate a lie to the world, saying that he had risen from the dead, which they knew not to be true because they're the ones who moved his dead body and apparently put it somewhere else. That is, I guess, what most people think is true if they're not believers. And not surprisingly, we're told in the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 28 tells us that this was the very story that the guards at the tomb were paid to circulate, that the disciples came and stole the body. Now, there's some problems with that, quite a few. One of them is, why would the disciples want to? Okay? I mean, this is the first thing. If you're going to do something, if you're going to perpetrate a hoax, you're going to have to have some reason to want to do it. It's not the easiest thing to perpetrate a hoax, and once you've foisted on people to keep everyone quiet about it. If you've got 11 men who know that this was a hoax, it's not easy to keep these people quiet, especially maybe later under torture, because they were tortured later on, and they still didn't reveal that they'd hoaxed the people. But the question is, why would they? Now, you know, people think, well, for power. The disciples didn't have any power before or after the resurrection in terms of, you know, carnal power. They didn't have political power. They didn't take money. You know, they didn't get rich for their leadership in the church. They just became a persecuted minority in Jerusalem. And then later, as the gospel spread to other countries, they were persecuted there, and eventually they were martyred. It's not exactly clear why guys who had all their lives made a reasonable living catching fish or doing other menial trades would decide to start a religion when they weren't even particularly educated or highly religious people, just so they could get chased from town to town and thrown in prison and eventually beheaded or crucified, as many of them were. So, I mean, the idea that the disciples have a reason to want to do this, to start a religion, doesn't make any sense. And, of course, the other thing is, even if they wanted to, could they? Could they steal the body and keep it a secret? The tomb was actually guarded by guards who were put there because some suspected the disciples might be want to remove the body. So they guarded it against that contingency. Now, the guards, of course, after the resurrection, had to account for the fact that they had lost their charge. They'd lost the body. And so they were paid by the Jewish Sanhedrin to tell people, well, the disciples stole it while we slept. Well, wait a minute. Why would it be while we slept? Guards don't sleep. Guards, Roman guards, as well as sentries and armies ever since, if you fall asleep and lose your charge, it's your head. You're going to die. Why would you make up a story like that? I mean, wouldn't it make more sense if you want to say the disciples took the body, say we were overpowered by the disciples. We didn't fall asleep. We were diligent, but we, you know, there were too many of them, not enough of us, and, you know, they just overwhelmed us. Well, of course, they couldn't say that, even though that would make them look better than falling asleep would. But they couldn't say that because if the disciples had, in fact, overcome the guards, it would have been by force. And where's the bloodshed? Where's the dead guards? Where's the wounded ones? You know, obviously, there was no evidence of a struggle like that, and there would be, because those guards, being Romans, would have defended their charge with their lives. You'd have a few dead disciples, too, probably. Some dead disciples and some dead guards, or at least wounds on a lot of these people. Never happened. No one ever claimed it happened. They had to make up a cock and bull story that, you know, they were asleep. And that would not look good for them. But the Sanhedrin said, you tell them that, and if the governor hears about this and you get in trouble, we'll, you know, we got some stuff on him. We got stuff on him. We can protect you from him. And so, anyway, there's really no, I mean, what else? How else did the tomb get empty? And then, of course, why did so many people think they saw him alive? Who, not in the distance, sitting at a table with him, sitting around a fire eating fish with him, talking with him, walking on the beach having a conversation, feeling his hands and feet as he invited them to so that they'd know it wasn't a hallucination. Yeah, I mean, let's face it. If a person does not accept the straightforward explanation of the empty tomb, namely that Jesus rose and came out as he predicted in advance that he would, then they've got to come up with stories that don't make any sense at all. And, you know, Occam's razor, obviously, is the theory that, you know, the simplest explanation that covers all the facts without needing, you know, secondary and tertiary theories added to it is probably the right one. But I think common sense would tell you that. Now, what's the argument against that Jesus rose from the dead? There's no witnesses, historical or otherwise, that have ever really brought any evidence or testimony that Jesus didn't rise from the dead. All the people who actually were there and knew something about it said he did. And the enemies of the gospel couldn't prove them wrong. So we got zero evidence for the proposition that Jesus did not rise from the dead. And we've got witnesses, multiple, that he did. What else? Well, besides that, you know, there's no reason to deny that Jesus rose from the dead unless you simply deny that that kind of thing can happen. Now, this is really what we've got going on for the skeptics. The skeptics don't have any evidence that he didn't rise from the dead. They don't have any rational reason to say he didn't rise from the dead. They have a prejudice. They have a bias. They're bigots against supernatural things happening. If a man can rise from the dead, then supernatural things happen. And frankly, if supernatural things happen, then a man rising from the dead might be among the possibilities. And so unless you've just ruled out that supernatural things could ever happen, you have absolutely no argument of any kind against the resurrection, only bigotry. And if you have ruled it out, that is, if you've ruled out supernatural occurrences, you've done so without sufficient inquiry. Because all around the world throughout history, there's the record and reports of people seeing lots of different kinds of things, which, you know, seem to be supernatural. Some of them probably are not, but a lot of them seem to be. A lot of the healings and so forth that, you know, there's no natural explanation for. And Jesus wasn't even the first one who was dead and came alive again, nor the last. The apostles raised some dead people, too. And Elijah and Elisha raised some dead people before Jesus came. So, you know, it's not as if it was totally unprecedented, but it's exceedingly rare. And if someone says, well, I don't know anyone who's ever seen a man rise from the dead, well, good for you. Neither have I. I don't think I ever will. The Bible doesn't lead me to expect to see it. The Bible doesn't say, hey, because the Bible's true, because Jesus rose from the dead, you're going to see people rise from the dead all over the place. No, the Bible indicates this was a unique event. This was not an ordinary event. So, and it says that God is the one who did it. So until you can prove there's no God, you can't prove that God didn't do this. And since whether you have a belief in God or not, you've got to deal with the facts and the evidence. The only rational one that doesn't require a bunch of silliness is that, you know, among the numerous supernatural things that have happened in the world, one of them is that Jesus rose from the dead, and explains all the data without any, you know, messing around with silly theories. It's simply the obvious case. All right, let's talk to, it's going to be Keith from Rancho Cucamonga, California. Keith, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hello. I enjoyed meeting you last night.
It's you. How are you doing?
Good. This is a very quick call, and God kind of placed it on my heart. And this is something that hopefully won't get you upset, but I know you wouldn't do it. But all those out there in radio land that invite Steve to talk, if you guys could, you know, just look after him in terms of financially, what he expended to get out there and spend the time with you guys, I think it'd be much appreciated. And I think it was something that we kind of discovered last night at the last minute. So whoever's going to organize these things for you in the future, hopefully they'll take that into consideration. And then
well,
secondly,
actually, some people did help me out. So I
appreciate
good.
I know
that,
they did, but it wasn't. You know, I felt it was kind of piecemeal at the end, but that's okay. I just didn't know. So,
before you get to your second question, I just want to say this: it's not necessary for anyone to help me out when I come, and I very gladly come at my own expense. Although I benefit from people's generosity too. So, your next question, yes.
It wasn't a question, it was a statement. Hopefully I won't get your ire up on this, but you mentioned that your wife has been and a great deal of pain over the years. And I think, you know, I'm just speaking on your behalf that maybe everybody can offer up in prayer on a regular basis and have that kind of pain. That regular has got to be quite an ordeal. And I've never heard you mention it, so I figured God kind of placed it on my heart to maybe mention that to the broader audience, that they would lift her up in prayer and alleviate her pain. And that's it.
Thank you, Keith. I appreciate your thoughts.
Okay, God bless you.
God bless you, too. It was good meeting you yesterday.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Let's see. James in Dallas, Texas. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I got a question that hopefully I can – I actually have two questions. If you're quick enough on the first one and I have time, I'll ask the second one. If not, I'll be happy with the first one. But this is just something – I'm kind of a logical thinker, and I've just not been able to wrap my head around this, and I haven't found any biblical evidence, and maybe you just may have to give me your opinion, but I'll let you decide. So here's the question. So, you know, we read that, and we kind of – most of us believe that when we do die and go to heaven that we will – know, you know, one another in heaven. So that's what kind of what this question is based on. So when we from the day we're born until the day we die, all of our experiences, the people we meet, everything goes into our brain as, you know, things that we do for our entire life. How we can think, we can remember what we did yesterday. This is all stored in, the way I understand it, the gray matter inside the brain. Now,
yeah, and then when you get really old, they go away again.
Yeah, that too. I'm getting there. So, yeah, I understand that. That saying that you can remember what you did yesterday, that's not always the case. But anyway, so we pass away and, you know, everything turns to dust and then we're in heaven, is all of our experiences, I thought they were stored inside that gray matter in our brain. Is that somehow imprinted, all that imprinted on our soul that goes with us? That's just what's always kind of confounded me.
Well, obviously, I don't know the answer to that. I mean, there'd be no way to know the answer to that unless God told us. But it's not as if we will lack a physical brain in the resurrection. We will have our bodies. We will have organ systems in our bodies. I assume brains and nervous system will be part of that, too. I don't know that to be true, but Jesus, when he rose from the dead, which is the, you know, the prototype of our resurrection bodies, he remembered things. He remembered what he'd told them before. He remembered them, obviously. So, you know, whether that's because there's a non-material part of us, our soul, where this information is stored, and the brain is simply the computer that accesses that from the cloud kind of thing, or whether it's stored on the hardware, I don't know. But it's not as if the brain will not exist in the resurrection. Now, of course, when we die and go to heaven, it's not our bodies that go. Our bodies will be resurrected on the last day. That's when we'll have these organs again, or like our brain. It is my understanding that we are disembodied for a brief period of time. That is after we die, but before Jesus comes back to raise us from the dead. And how much our memories will contain there, or whether we'll have them much or not, I don't know. You're right, we do assume we'll recognize each other in heaven, but the Bible doesn't specifically say that. And it may well be that we won't recognize each other until the resurrection. I have no idea. The Bible doesn't raise that question or answer it for us. So I'm going to have to disappoint you on that particular one. Now, you had another question. Instead of taking it right this minute, I think we have to take a break first, and I'm going to come back with another half hour. And then I'll put you back on the air for your second question, then we'll move to the other callers. So hang in there, and our listeners need to be told, or at least some of them do, because not everyone know, that The Narrow Path has been on the air for 29 years, daily. Started out on one station, then two, and now we're on 80-something stations around the country. And all these stations charge money. That's not to their discredit. They are businesses, and they have to run. And therefore, they charge for time on the air. And virtually every radio program you listen to is being purchased. The time is being purchased. And that being so, we have to pay for the time on the air. Now, we don't have a fundraising mechanism. We don't sell anything. We don't have any sponsors. We just let people know, and that's all we do. And this is all we've done for 29 years, and all these bills have gotten paid because it's usually just enough to let our audience know. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, we are listener-supported. And if you don't know this, if you send support to the Narrow Path, no part of that money will go to paying any remuneration or salaries or perks or anything for anyone who volunteers for this ministry, including myself and my wife and many others volunteer to bring this ministry to you. All are unpaid volunteers. So the entire income is used to purchase airtime. So we can bring the program to you all over the country, all over the world through internet, essentially for free to you, because we pay for these stations. And that's where all donations go. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can do it from the website. By the way, the website is loaded with resources, far more than we provide on the radio. Check it out. They're all free at thenarrowpath.com. I'll be off the air for 30 seconds. We'll come back. We have another half hour. Don't go away.
Small is the gate and narrow is the path that leads to life. Welcome to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Steve has nothing to sell you, but everything to give you. When today's radio show is over, we invite you to study, learn, and enjoy by visiting thenarrowpath.com, where you'll find free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all The Narrow Path radio shows. We thank you for supporting the listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Remember, thenarrowpath.com.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for another half hour taking your calls. Actually, our lines are full, so don't bother calling right now. I'll give the number out again if we have lines open and time to spare before the show is over. I want to remind some who may be interested in Southern California that we have a monthly men's Bible study in Temecula one Saturday a month. That's tomorrow at 8 o'clock in the morning. And much less frequently, maybe two, three, maybe four times a year, I speak at the Orange County Rescue Mission, which is called the Village of Hope in Tustin, California. And I'll be speaking tomorrow night there. They have a chapel service there. And when I do, it's just a Q&A. But they got a room full of people who are involved in different degrees of rehabilitation and so forth, and they have a lot of questions from the Bible. But it's not an open meeting, but we did check, and they will allow guests to come. So if you happen to be in Orange County and want to join us tomorrow night at 6:30, it's at the Orange County Rescue Mission called the Village of Hope. Information is at our website, thenarrowpath.com. It's a gated place. It's not high security or anything like this, but it's gated. And if you do come as a guest, you have to kind of go to the desk and tell them you're here for the chapel service. All right, enough on that. Let's talk to these people who've been waiting for a while. James from Dallas, Texas, was on before. He had a second question. James, we can get to that quickly, but perhaps.
Yeah, I'll make this quick. I'm sure you've probably answered this one before, but your answer to my first question kind of leads into this question. When Jesus was resurrected, and you mentioned he had obviously had a brain and remembered stuff, my question on that is, if he was in his resurrected body, why do you think he still had his wounds from being crucified?
Well, they helped to identify him to the apostles. They weren't sure it was really him. Remember, Thomas said, "I won't believe he's alive until I see the holes in his hands and put my hand in the hole in his side." So that made it very clear this was not some imposter, some different person who kind of looked like him. This was the same person they had seen crucified. Now, whether these scars are there for all eternity or not, I don't know. Some have said that such scars and wounds as we receive, you know, in suffering in the will of God, like martyrs, those would be like jewels and crowns to us in eternity, you know. But obviously some people are so disfigured, even beheaded and dismembered in martyrdom, that it's, you know, obviously they're going to be put back together. So I don't know to what degree any scars or wounds on any of the rest of us will be part of our resurrected bodies. And I'm not even sure that his wounds will necessarily be always there either, or whether that was just necessary before his ascension. You know, I don't know. I'm not answering with any knowledge at all about this.
Okay.
All right?
All right. Okay, I appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Okay, James. Thanks for your call. Okay, we're going to talk next to Michael from Inglewood, California. Michael, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi. Thanks, Steve. I was just at a Bible study, and the pastor was preaching about Revelation 22:15, and it mentions outside the gates are dogs and sexually immoral.
Mm-hmm.
And he was saying that the word for dogs, which is actually the same word for homosexuals, kind of in relation to Deuteronomy 23:18. And I couldn't find a Greek or Hebrew word that would be the same for dogs, especially since it says outside the gates are dogs and sexually immoral. So I guess, mm-hmm, my question is, does dogs mean sexually, I mean homosexuals?
Probably not. Like you said, the sexually immoral are mentioned as a separate category from dogs. Dogs probably do not refer to literal canines. It's probably a metaphor, like when Jesus said, don't give what is holy to dogs and don't cast your pearls before swine. Dogs, to the Jewish mind, represent an unclean creature. Now, you remember that the Jews used the term dogs as a slur against Gentiles, because Gentiles were not circumcised. They didn't have the law. They were considered, morally unclean or spiritually unclean. And the Jews referred to Gentiles as dogs. And even Jesus did that in speaking to the Gentile woman, saying, well, we're not supposed to give the food that's for the children to the dogs. But, some people were very offended that he said that, but she wasn't. She knew she was an unclean Gentile. And she said, but even the dogs get to eat the scraps that fall from the master's table. He said, oh, woman, great is your faith, be it unto you as you desired. In other words, the term dog meant not a member of the family, and the children, the Jews, at one point, were God's family members, his children. Gentiles were like animals, unclean animals. Now, of course, Revelation chapter 22 is not referring to Gentiles, because very obviously earlier in Revelation in chapter 7 he saw a great multitude that no one could number from every nation and tribe and kindred and tongue, which means all nation, all ethnicities, which would be Gentiles primarily, and he saw these innumerable number of them in heaven worshiping Christ. And so obviously to say dogs will not be in the New Jerusalem is not saying that Gentiles won't be. So what dogs refers to is not clear, except we could say maybe using the term dog to speak of an unclean person, which the Jews did in speaking about Gentiles, could still be used to speak of a person who's unclean without reference to their race, whether Jew or Gentile, but rather their behaviors. It's a strange statement. To be sure, it's not the only strange statement in the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation has a lot of strange statements, but I'm going to assume that it kind of has the same function in that passage as the word dog functioned among the Jews speaking of unclean people, namely Gentiles. But now, of course, unclean people is not identified as Gentiles per se. Actually, Jews can be as much so. Paul said in Philippians chapter 3, he said, beware of dogs. Beware of the circumcision, or the cutters, he said. Yeah, there were Jewish people trying to make the Gentiles circumcise themselves as Christians. He called them dogs, which was an irony because, of course, the Jews spoke of the Gentiles as dogs. And Paul's now writing to Gentiles saying, look out for those dogs who want to circumcise you. So in any case, the word dog was used in various passages to mean somebody who's unclean before God. And that's probably generically what it means in the book of Revelation as well. All right. Keith from Battleground, Washington. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hello, Steve. I've got a subject I wanted to discuss was whether Christian parents should baptize their infants as small children. And what I was hoping to do is just give a brief background of what I've heard you and other people say regarding that, and then I've got a couple of questions associated with that.
Okay, if it doesn't go on too long, quickly, yes.
Yeah, it would take about 2 minutes to do that, or I can shorten it up more if you want.
Just be as brief as you can. We've got a lot of people waiting. Yep.
Okay. So people that oppose infant baptism commonly state that they don't want to rely on church tradition. They want to rely on what the Bible says about baptism.
Mm-hmm.
And then they generally state two reasons that are offered as the biblical basis for their opposition to infant baptism. So reason one is that the only people that were baptized in the New Testament were those who the Bible says first believed before they were baptized.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, infants are intellectually incapable of believing and should not be baptized. And then reason number two is baptism just signifies that you're born again, or it's just an outward sign of an inward change or a public confession of your faith. And therefore, we should only baptize people who are already Christians, and infants are intellectually incapable of making all those decisions to be a Christian and therefore should not be baptized. So my two questions are, the question number one is in Acts 16, the account of Lydia's conversion.
Mm-hmm.
Can you read the part where it says the members of Lydia's household believed before they were baptized? Because I don't see that anywhere in the verses. And then my second question is, can you read for me anywhere in the Bible where it says baptism signifies you're born again or is an outward sign of an inward change?
No, I can't. But there are two cases where in the book of Acts that we read of a whole household being baptized. One of those is, of course, in the case of Lydia. She and her household were baptized. The other was the house of Cornelius, which was an earlier record in chapter 16. Of course, Cornelius' household were baptized too, but more the household baptism is mentioned in chapter 16 with reference to the Philippian jailer. And we don't read the specific information about Lydia's family believing, but the fact that they were baptized, and that we don't know of anyone ever baptizing unbelievers, it's sort of like saying, I got baptized last week. You might say, well, what's that mean? What's it mean? Well, it means I'm a Christian. It means I became a Christian. I'm a believer now. That's why people get baptized, because they're Christians. There's no other reason that people ever got baptized in the Bible that we know of. But in the house of the Philippian jailer, it says in verse 33, he took Paul and Silas the same hour of the night, washed their stripes, and immediately he and all his family were baptized. Okay, so there's the other case. One is in, Acts earlier. Actually, here we have a whole family being baptized, just like Lydia's family was. Now, the next verse says, now when they had brought them into his house, he set food before them, and they rejoiced, having believed in God with all his household. Okay, so all his household believed in God, and all his household got baptized. So, obviously,
I think it's pretty clear in all the other accounts. Lydia's is the only one where I didn't see that. And I guess maybe a little follow-up question would be, do you believe that there's like a 0% chance that the household of Lydia contained any small children or infants or people that didn't first believe before they were baptized?
Well, we don't know how many Christian households had or converted households had little children. I would say this though, that if every person in the household was baptized, like the household of the Philippian jailer, we would have reason to believe that they all believed, just like the household of the Philippian jailer. I mean, that's the household baptism is accompanied by believing. Now, when it says that all of her household were baptized, because we live at a time where many denominations have practiced infant baptism, we might assume that if there were infants in the household, they would be included in all the household that were baptized. But the word all, of course, in many passages of Scripture, is not absolutely universal. I mean, let's just say her household had a lot of people in it. Maybe they had a baby or two even. But you know, if there's eight people and two babies, and the eight people get baptized, the baby's not being included, that would not prevent it from being said her whole household was baptized. I mean, that is to suggest the house, you know, the members of the household who were involved in the conversion that Lydia had. Lydia was converted, and we have to assume that if she baptized her whole household, they were converted too. You know, I don't really see anything that would support
it. But if you assume it's consistent with the others, then that would be your position?
Well, yeah, if it's consistent with Christian practice. Yeah, I mean, we don't have to guess whether it was the practice of Christians to bring people to faith and then baptize them. We have multitudes of indicators of that in Acts and in the epistles, but and in church history. But the question of whether sometimes babies were baptized is a separate question, because we know that babies have not been converted yet. They haven't repented. They haven't believed yet. They're babies. And therefore, to say, but though we have no record of it ever happening, we're going to suggest that sometimes babies, unconverted babies, were baptized. Well, we're not going to have any Bible support of that. And the only way you get it is by reading it between the lines in a passage that doesn't say it, namely about Lydia's household. So I'm just, you know, I'm not going to go with traditions of the church that you have to read things between the lines in one passage to support your position, when all the other passages on the subject indicate that baptism comes along with believing.
Okay.
That's how I question. Oh, yep.
Yeah. How about the second question?
The second was? Oh, is there anything that says that baptism is just a sign of conversion?
Yes.
Well, no, we don't have the term sign used there, which is important, because those who do baptize infants argue that baptism is the sign of the new covenant, just like circumcision was the sign, and the Bible does use the word sign for circumcision. And those who argue for infant baptism say it's parallel to circumcision. Circumcision in the old covenant has its parallel in baptism in the new covenant. Now, we know that circumcision was a sign. We know that circumcision didn't bring about a supernatural result in an 8-year-old Jewish baby. It was just a sign of the covenant. That's what God said very specifically about circumcision when he first instituted it in Genesis 17. He told Abraham it's a sign of the covenant. Circumcise your males. Now, I have. I mean, it's the primary argument in all the books on baptism of infants I've read. That it's like, you know, the Jews circumcise their infants, and so Christians baptize their babies. I don't know what you've read on it, but if you read a book defending infant baptism and they didn't mention that, that's very strange, because I've read lots of books defending it. That's their primary argument. That's what they lead with. And so in any way, you know, if baptism is not the parallel to circumcision, then you've got no case for infant baptism at all. The whole case for infant baptism is based on the infant circumcision. On the other hand, if baptism is the parallel to circumcision in the Old Testament, well, circumcision is said to be a sign, and we should assume that then baptism is a sign too. We don't have a direct statement that baptism is a sign. I don't even care if it is or not. I mean, it's not something I care to defend. It's just you know, the information we have seems to support that. But if someone says, I don't think we have enough information to support that, I'd say, okay, then don't. You don't have to believe that. I have nothing at stake in my suggestion that baptism is a sign of, you know, burial and resurrection with Christ. It's an antitype. Peter said that the type of baptism was, one of them in the Bible, was Noah's family being saved through water in the flood. And he says the antitype to that is baptism. Okay, an antitype means it's the thing that something else is the type of. So salvation through the flood was the type. Baptism is the antitype. Okay, so It's an antitype. An antitype, the suggestion that something, you know, is a type of something else, it doesn't tell us anything about whether there's something supernatural that takes place in it. Noah and his family were saved through the flood. Certainly the flood was supernatural, but the ark was not. You know, getting into the ark was something they did. Sure, God shut the door. And, you know, we recognize God's role in saving the family. But going into the ark was not one of the supernatural things that happened. You know, that other things happened around it. So, you know, I just don't see anything in the Bible that tells me that baptism does something supernaturally to somebody. I know that, you know, for example, Roman Catholics, I don't know if maybe you're Roman Catholic, they believe that it cleanses from original sin. Well, that's nice, but it's just not something the Bible tells us. Lutherans and Presbyterians and many Calvinists, they practice infant baptism too, but they don't have exactly the same theory that Catholics do about it. Partly because each group has to come up with their own theory, because there's nothing in the Bible that gives us an explanation of what baptism does for infants, simply because the Bible doesn't mention any baptism of infants, so you're not going to get any theological propositions from there about it.
Yeah, I think...
Yeah?
Hello?
Go ahead.
Hello. Yeah, I think it does tell us what baptism does in Romans 6. And Colossians 2, and then again in at Paul's conversion, where the washing away of sins, and those are all consistent with what Peter said in 1 Peter 3, which you referred to, where it says baptism now saves you not as a washing away of dirt from the body, but as an appeal to God for a good conscience.
Well,
so I think
you're certainly welcome. You're certainly welcome to listen to my verse by verse lectures on those passages. Those are extremely familiar passages. They make up primarily the whole case for baptismal regeneration for those who believe it. I personally believe that in their context, each of those passages can be understood somewhat differently than that. And, you know, if a person is not saved without being baptized, and maybe that's the point you're making. I don't know if you're I'm assuming you're Church of, well, maybe you're not Church of Christ because you believe in infant baptism. But, yeah, I mean, you obviously believe that baptism is something that saves a person literally. And Peter saying baptism now saves you, I think we have to understand. Well, if you listen to my verse by verse, you'll understand what I think he says. There's too much involved in going through all these verses. But I have never avoided them. In fact, I have a couple of lectures on baptism where I cover all those points too. At thenarrowpath.com under topical lectures, there's a series called Foundations. And there's lectures on water baptism there. I certainly cover your points there, too. Anyway, my lines are full. I'm looking at I've got like 6 minutes left. So I'm going to have to take another caller. But feel free to access my material. It's all at thenarrowpath.com. I don't know if you really want to hear my side. But if you do, it's certainly available there. Thanks for calling. All right. Let's talk to Jeff in Ocala, Florida. Welcome to The Narrow Path, Jeff.
Hey, thank you for taking my call, Steve. I'm a regular listener during my job. I stopped working now and just happened to turn on the radio, and there you are again. It just gives me some joy and encouragement growing the faith.
Great. Do you have a question?
Yes, my question is first that I'm going to embark on this approach to studying the Bible called systematic theology. And the introduction of this, the teacher had some, for example, some perspective like as a Calvinist and as a preterist and all that. That beside the point, I just want to know your views and recommendation on this approach.
Okay. Well, systematic theology simply means, there's books called systematic theology by different authors where they systematize theology. And theology refers to all the different specific doctrines related to Christianity. So the doctrine of salvation, the doctrine of heaven and hell, the doctrine of the Trinity, the doctrine of creation, the doctrine of the fall, you know, the doctrine of whatever, angels, that kind of stuff. And, you know, what a book like that does, it goes through all those different doctrinal subjects, and then it tries to systematize, that's why it's called systematized theology. They systematize all the biblical data on this topic, each topic, you know. And so I don't think there's anything wrong with doing that. Now, you mentioned the one you're using is Calvinistic, and an awful lot of them are. It seems like Calvinists are the most interested people in writing systematic theologies, but some, there are systematic theologies that are not Calvinistic. But it does seem like most of the ones on my shelf are written by Calvinists because they seem to like to put out books on systematic theology. Fine. I mean, I don't know what one to recommend. To study systematic theologies, I systematize my theology in my head for the most part. I mean, not only in my head, I've organized it on paper too, but I don't know what to say about it except that everyone who's a rational and logical person is going to systematize their theology somewhat. Otherwise, they won't be able to put together the biblical data on a subject into a coherent pattern. And, of course, God's truth is organized. God's truth does go into logical patterns. So, reading the Bible to study a topic is really what systematic theology does, only it takes all the major topics of theology and kind of gives topical studies of the Bible on it. In my lectures online, I don't call them systematic theology, but if you read my lectures about what are we to make of Israel, or when shall these things be, or, you know, knowing God, what you'll find my lectures do is they take these topics. They take eschatology in the case of when shall these things be. They take Israelology in the case of what do we make of Israel. They take, the theology of the Trinity and so forth in knowing God. These are things that systematic theologians do. I do that in my lectures. And I think that anybody who takes a logical and organized approach to understanding the Bible in some measure is practicing systematic theology. It's a good thing to do, But realize that when you read a book of systematic theology, it will not lack the opinions of the author based on his own theology on some things. You just have to read with discernment. I mean, if he says the Bible says this about that, you just have to look at the Bible and say, does it? If it does, then he's right. If it doesn't, then keep learning elsewhere. I appreciate your call. Jimmy in Staten Island, New York. We don't have much time. I'm sorry for your call. I know that you always have kind of deep questions. I think I might take another Jimmy who we don't hear from much. Jimmy in Jamesport, Missouri. We only have about a minute or so. But Jimmy, go ahead.
Hi, Steve. I'll make it really quick.
Okay.
I'm just wondering, is it possible to apostatize? I'm not worried about there's no sense.
Is it possible to apostatize? I just need your question.
That's not my question.
Okay. We got
1 minute. Is it possible
to
apostatize without knowing it in your heart and yet be orthodox in your head?
I think so. I think a person can drift away from God cluelessly. But it shouldn't be hard to figure it out if you examine yourself. You know, Paul said in 2 Corinthians 13, examine your own selves and see if you are in the faith. Now, of course, he was writing to Christians who had been in the faith. He's saying you better check it out and see if you still are, obviously. Examine yourself. You just have to ask yourself, am I still following Jesus, or have I had other things that have crowded him out and eclipsed him in my concerns? If the latter is true, I need to repent and get back to placing Christ first. Then I won't be apostate. Now, no, I'm not. But one thing I know is I'm out of time. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. Have a good weekend. Thanks for joining us.